Okay, so this weekend is the White House Correspondents' Dinner, where comedian Colin Jost will be roasting the president and the Washington Press Corps. So I wanted to ask you guys, if there was one person or an entity that you could have roasted by a professional comedian, who or what would it be? Aaron?
Oh, boy. Give me a second.
I would want roasted the giant pandas that were at the National Zoo because I just think they're overrated and it's time for them to be taken down a peg.
Wow. I think this podcast just got canceled. Would you like to say some mean things about Caitlin Clark or maybe puppy dogs at this point?
Absolutely not.
I'm not going to say their name, but there was... It's very weird the things that you hold on to, but there was a teacher that I had when I was young who did not like a very specific report that I had done, and it was about whales. I remember it very vividly, and I am still bitter about that 30 years later, and I would like for that teacher to be roasted very badly.
Aaron's third grade teacher. Okay.
I didn't say third grade. You know who you are if you're listening.
Aaron, you're going to hear from that teacher later today, I have a feeling, potentially with an apology.
I hope so.
Welcome to The Campaign Moment. This is Friday, April 26th, and I'm Elahe Azadi.
And hi, I'm Aaron Blake. Also along for the ride in The Campaign Moment this week is Colby Itkowitz, national politics reporter for The Post.
Hey, guys.
So, Aaron, what are we talking about this week?
Well, this week we are going to take a little bit of a break from the Trump Manhattan trial, which we talked about in our bonus episode on Wednesday that people should check out. We're going to dig in a little bit more to the congressional primaries on Tuesday, House politics, the Gaza protests that are happening on college campuses around the country, and then we're going to dig into some of the latest polling on the 2024 campaign.
Yeah, so much to unpack, and I'm so happy that we have Colby here, because first, I wanted to ask Colby about what Democrats can learn from what happened in Pennsylvania. So, Colby, can you first just tell us a little bit about some of the coverage that you've been doing of Democrats in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, I mean, what we saw happen on Tuesday is we had, you know, a number of races cemented for the fall that could decide control of Congress, both in the Senate and the House. We already knew on the Senate side that it was going to be a race between Bob Casey, the incumbent, and Dave McCormick. But now that race is set and will be one of the most closely watched and most expensive Senate races in the country, largely because, you know, Pennsylvania will be one of the most closely watched and expensive battleground states in the presidential race. But there were also some really interesting House races that happened. And I was really focused on one, Representative Scott Perry, who's considered, you know, one of the architects of the efforts to undermine the results of the 2020 presidential elections. He was named repeatedly in the January 6th Select Committee's report. He had multiple meetings in the White House about how to potentially overturn the results in Trump's favor. He represents a district that, you know, it leans Republican, but Democrat Josh Shapiro, the governor of Pennsylvania, won it by 12 points in 2022. So it's winnable for a Democrat. And he's considered by Democrats one of the few, maybe one of the only, quote, election deniers, people that voted against certifying the election in 2020 that can be beat by a Democrat. And they elected in a competitive primary on Tuesday a woman named Janelle Stelzin, who's been a local TV news anchor in the area for almost 40 years. So she has incredibly high name ID. She's very trusted by the community. And the Democrats really think that she, also as a woman, can really speak authoritatively on issues of abortion, issues of preserving democracy, and may in fact be someone that can take Scott Perry down.
Yeah, I'm glad we're talking about some of these other races because obviously so much attention, and rightfully so, should be paid to the presidential election. But whoever becomes president, a lot of what they can do, their agenda, whether they can enact it or not, will depend on the control of the House and the Senate.
Yeah, it's hugely important. We've seen the kind of fruits of the last election this Congress with the way House Republicans have struggled mightily to deal with a very closely divided House. They have had to go get votes from Democrats to pass a lot of things like foreign aid. And so these, you know, margins are very significant. If Democrats were to take the House, that's a very significant development for what legislation is going to be produced. Because if they had been in charge for, you know, the last Congress here, we would have seen foreign aid passed a very long time ago. So, you know, a few seats moving here or there in the 2022 election had pretty profound impact on when Ukraine is actually going to get that money. It wouldn't have taken several months like it has. And so that's why I think people should really be paying close attention. And we're going to be paying close attention to these House and Senate races moving forward.
And Colby, for you, as you continue to watch what's going on in Pennsylvania, what will you be paying attention to? And do you think national Democrats are really paying very close attention to try to take some lessons away from what's going on there?
What was also interesting in Pennsylvania's primary was just the margins in which President Biden and former President Trump won those primaries. Obviously, they're not competitive. No one's running against Biden or Trump anymore in primaries. And yet you saw a significant number of registered Republican Pennsylvanians. Now, it's closed primaries in Pennsylvania, which means only, you know, if you're registered to a party, can you vote in that party's primary? You saw 150,000 registered Republicans in Pennsylvania vote for Nikki Haley.
Whoa. Wait, she's not even in the race anymore.
She left the race in early March. And so...
Well, how many people voted in the primary, Republican primary overall? Like, what percentage would you say that is?
So that amounts overall to about, I think it's about 17%.
Oh, wow.
You know, Biden beat Trump in Pennsylvania by only 80,000 votes, and Trump beat Hillary Clinton in 2016 by around 44,000. So the loss of 150,000 votes is huge. Now, what we don't know and won't be clear until November is what do those 150,000 registered Republicans do? Do they end up coming home to Trump in the fall? Do they defect and go to Biden? Maybe they're already Biden supporters from 2020. But what's important there is that Biden won Pennsylvania in 2020. And so if those voters that voted for him in 2020 are still resistant to Trump, that I think that bodes quite well for the president.
Yeah. And this is the most recent closed state where we've seen this significant defection, the closed primary is one in which only Republicans have voted. So early on, we had a bunch of contests that allowed independents to vote. And, you know, Nikki Haley and kind of the non-Trump vote was 20% or higher. But as we've seen states with closed primaries vote, we haven't seen that share of the vote fall away that much. It's been around 20% or more in a lot of these closed primary states that have voted long after Nikki Haley dropped out of the race. And that's significant because, again, these are actual Republicans. I don't want to oversell it. I think it's worth looking back at history on this. There were significant votes that were against George W. Bush in the 2000 primaries after John McCain dropped out, pretty similar to what we're seeing today. Ditto, Bernie Sanders supporters were still voting for him after he dropped out of the race in 2020 in somewhat similar numbers. So it's not a deal breaker, but I think it does point to a potential liability. And the fact that we're seeing more Republican primary voters continuing to vote against Donald Trump than Democratic primary voters voting against President Biden, I think is at least potentially significant.
And there were protest votes of Biden as well, around 6%. Voted for Dean Phillips, the congressman from Minnesota. And there was also some significant number, also around 6% of write-ins against President Biden. We don't know yet what they wrote in. It could have been uncommitted, which is an effort that's been in other primary states as a protest to what's happening in Gaza. But those details we don't know yet.
Yeah, it's super fascinating. Yeah, we'll have to keep paying attention to that. And Aaron, you had mentioned the foreign aid package that moved through Congress. And that's where I would love for us to turn next, because President Biden on Wednesday signed a $95 billion foreign aid package into law. And this is the one that will give about $61 billion for Ukraine funding and also replenish U.S. weapons stockpiles. And this happened as soldiers in Ukraine are, you know, literally running out of bullets. So this came after months of negotiation. The president signed it after the House had passed this package, and it did have bipartisan support. So just first of all, let's remind ourselves what made this process take so long.
It's a really good question. I think it's worth emphasizing that the package that was ultimately passed in the House very similar to the one that passed in the Senate. And, you know, similar dollar amounts. There were some kind of differences around the edges. But it took months and months to get to this point. We had 81% of the Senate sign off on this package. We had 73% of the House, who, you know, the members who were actually voting, voting in support of Ukraine funding specifically. And yet it takes months and months. I think you can make an argument that this kind of epitomizes a broken Congress, that something like that takes so long to work its way through. But, you know, there were politics that had to be massaged here on the Republican side. A majority of Republicans in the House did not vote for the Ukraine aid. And generally speaking, a majority will want things that come to the floor to be supported by a majority of their conference. And so Speaker Mike Johnson had to kind of, you know, arrange the deck chairs in a way that made this at least somewhat palatable to his party. And so initially we had the effort to tie Ukraine funding and foreign aid to an immigration, you know, deal that fell apart in the Senate when Republicans got cold feet, you know, decided that this wasn't something they wanted to do. Former President Trump came out against that package. And then the House moved on to some other things before they came back to this. But it all kind of wound up in the same place that it started, you know, so many months ago. And I think that's kind of a testament to how difficult the House Republican Conference has been having things since they took the majority in 2022.
Yeah. And I mean, speaking of which, there is this dynamic that I've dubbed the Marjorie Taylor Greene dynamic. And Aaron, you and I have talked about this before, and it's played out with moving this Ukraine aid through the House, where House Speaker Mike Johnson was under this pressure from the far right in his conference in the House to get this bill through. There were elements there opposed, namely Marjorie Taylor Greene, who is now talking about trying to get rid of him. And, you know, the origin of this is the previous House Speaker, Kevin McCarthy, made this deal essentially that any one member could, you know, push a vote through to push out the speaker, basically. And that's what happened to him. And that's how Mike Johnson ended up in his job. And so now you have Marjorie Taylor Greene threatening to do this. I wonder, from both of you, how is the Republican Party feeling about this dynamic, this Marjorie Taylor Greene dynamic right now?
Well, we're starting to see some real concern about it, I think. It's one thing to do this in 2023 when, you know, electoral politics aren't necessarily front and center. It's another to do it with about 6 months to go in the 2024 election. I think you're seeing some real concern that this is only reinforcing some real concerns that Americans have about Republicans' ability to govern. There was a poll this week that showed a majority of Americans thought that Democrats were good at passing legislation, but just 28% thought that Republicans were. And so we've started to see some Republicans and conservative media start to kind of crack down, or at least try to crack down, on Marjorie Taylor Greene and criticize her. Senator Tom Tillis, the Republican from North Carolina this week, told CNN that she was a waste of time.
I think she's uninformed. She is a total waste of time. She is a horrible leader. She is dragging our brand down. She, not the Democrats, are the biggest risk to us getting back to a majority.
Fox News, New York Post, Wall Street Journal, even Newsmax have been somewhat critical of her efforts to potentially take down Mike Johnson and her opposition to the Ukraine aid. It's really interesting to me that, you know, three of those outlets that I mentioned are part of the Murdoch media empire. You know, certainly that empire has shown it's willing to kind of craft a message to certain members of the Republican Party to try and guide them in a certain direction. And I think that there is just kind of a palpable sense that what Marjorie Taylor Greene is doing with this potential motion to vacate is hurting the party at a time when they need to focus on other things.
Yeah. And I think notably, you even saw President Trump come to Mike Johnson's defense after this vote. He kind of talked about the electoral politics. He said, you know, it's a closely divided House. We don't have the votes. And so what Trump said is, you know, if we want our priorities passed, we need to vote more Republicans into Congress. We need a larger majority in the House and in the Senate. And that, you know, is what we need to do. But this is not, you know, basically Mike Johnson did what he had to do, even though it's something that Trump, you know, personally may disagree with. And so I thought that was really notable that Trump, who considers Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, an ally, has not sided with her in this effort to oust Mike Johnson.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I also wonder, Colby, just from your reporting on the ground, talking to voters, do you have any sense of how, you know, voters are feeling about Republicans in the House right now and the way that they've been running things?
I think voters are frustrated. I think voters look at Congress, they look at the way Washington is run, and they believe that it's broken. And I think that will ultimately, you know, bode well, or it may bode well for Democrats in the fall, because, you know, Democrats keep coming back to this idea that they're just trying to govern and that it's the Republican Party that's broken and it's the Republican Party that's intransigent and keeps shaking up their leadership while the Democrats appear unified. And I know we're going to talk a little bit later in the show about some of the things that are tearing the Democratic Party apart.
Right.
But when it comes to these kind of policy questions in Washington, the Democrats largely kind of stick together. You see, like, AOC and even people like Ilhan Omar have said that Joe Biden needs to be reelected. They've unified around the president in a way that, you know, Republicans don't do around their leadership.
And I think that the Marjorie Taylor Greene thing, it just kind of epitomizes this tension in the Republican Party between what's best for the party and what's best for an individual member who, you know, either wants to drive the party in a certain direction or wants to, you know, get notoriety for themselves. This is something we've seen over and over again in the Republican Party, where these politicians earn a significant following by attacking other politicians. And there's been some evidence that that's moved the party in their direction. But this is also, again, a moment in which the party wants to focus on Democrats. And we're seeing a lot of the commentary around Marjorie Taylor Greene and her effort here, you know, a lot of the pushback on it, focused on the idea that this is just not the time for this kind of thing to be happening. And so it's going to be really interesting to see. She hasn't filed the motion to vacate yet. She suggests that she's still moving forward with it. But can she be kind of be talked off of this by some of the more electorally minded members of her party? And I think that's begun a little bit, but it's a delicate thing to do because, you know, nobody wants to make an enemy of Marjorie Taylor Greene, given she does have something of a following.
Well, let's just take a quick break here because I want to come back and we will talk about some of the divisions on the Democratic side, including reactions to the pro-Palestinian protests on college campuses and also the pressure that that is putting on President Biden.
Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, the Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Classes in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.
You know, for a few weeks now, there have been pro-Palestinian protests on college campuses across the country. And I want to talk about this right now because there are some political implications to all this. We talked about the protests earlier this week on Post Reports. A lot of these students are calling for their schools to divest from business with Israel and also wanting to draw attention to the humanitarian situation in Gaza. And also you have students and some lawmakers that have said that these campuses have become unsafe for Jewish students and decrying what they see as anti-Semitic rhetoric. What I want to ask in this space is, how are these protests playing out politically in this campaign year?
Yeah, I think it's a powder keg right now. The White House has talked about these protests as being maybe unrepresentative of the broader Democratic coalition. They've noted that they're taking place largely on the campuses of elite colleges. They've said that these are people who are not really representative of the Democratic Party more broadly, and that the protests are not really targeting Biden politically. And so the White House has kind of taken that as license to have something of a hands-off approach to this. The president's kind of broadly talked about how anti-Semitic rhetoric is not okay. He's not really done the kinds of things that Republican governors are doing by calling in, you know, the state patrol. This is happening in Georgia and Texas now, you know, getting the authorities involved in, you know, potentially cracking down on these things. I think that's going to be tested over time if this continues to be kind of a longstanding thing where there are real tensions that are spilling over and there are remote classes taking place and there are scenes that pop up that, you know, make this more dicey. But I think this is kind of an extension of Biden's approach to the war in Gaza more broadly. He's kind of not really choosing sides these days. Like, we're still sending money to Israel, but Biden's rhetoric has been kind of in the middle. And I think that's a recognition that, you know, going too hard on one side or the other is a recipe for potentially turning off some key voters in the Democratic Party, which is pretty split down the middle on this particular issue.
Well, what's interesting to me, I mean, I hear your point, Aaron, about there's this open question as to whether these very impassioned demonstrators are part of the Democratic base, but they're young people. I mean, shouldn't these be the people that the Democratic Party is trying to get? And what's interesting is that I see this passion on the left on this, but I don't know if I see that reflected among Democratic elected leaders equally. It does feel like, I don't know, you cited the polling about how the party's split, but it's not like the lawmakers are split on this.
Yeah, and we saw a strong vote for the Israel aid in the House among Democrats. I think that it's a point well taken that this certainly doesn't reflect where the members of Congress and the Democratic Party are. But the youth vote is important here. This is a demographic that has been trending away from President Biden, according to the polls, for a while now. I think it's important to note that that predates the war in Gaza, so it's not necessarily just about that. There's some polling that suggests that voters under 30 are actually significantly more concerned about inflation and abortion rights than they are the war in Gaza. But I think this just kind of layers a complicating factor on top of it. If this is something that a significant, even a small but significant number of youth voters decide is kind of a deal breaker for them, that Biden hasn't done enough on this issue, you know, layer that on top of other reservations that they might have about him, and it's a significant issue. These are fine margins that we have in this country. So just because something isn't a big issue for half of voters doesn't mean it's not a significant issue in the election.
Colby, I know you've done some really fascinating reporting on individual races around the country that are turning or turned on this issue. Can you share what you found?
Yeah, so it's interesting. We actually saw one on Tuesday in the Pennsylvania primary. You saw Summer Lee, who is a member of, you know, the so-called squad of House progressives who have been incredibly critical of Israel from the start of this war. She was kind of the first squad member to face a primary this year from someone who was coming at it from a more pro-Israel perspective. And so there's a few things to take away from that race, or a few things that are, you know, we shouldn't draw massive conclusions from the results, but Summer Lee won in a district that has really deep Jewish roots. It's a district where the Tree of Life synagogue shooting occurred several years ago. And so there's a lot of deep support for Israel in that district, and yet she prevailed. What's important to note, of course, is that the pro-Israel groups, the really well-funded, heavily influenced groups like AIPAC, didn't really play in that race. They didn't think that they had, that the challenger was strong enough maybe to unseat the incumbent, the way that they're looking at unseating other members of the squad later this summer, particularly Jamal Bowman in New York and Cori Bush in Missouri. They believe that they have two very strong pro-Israel challengers in the Democratic primaries and later this summer. And really believe that they can take out those two squad members who, again, have been among the most vocal in opposition to Israel and to Israel's war in Gaza. So it's hard to say whether or not we can learn much from the Summer Lee race, whether or not we can say that her win is an endorsement of kind of the criticisms of Israel, because we don't really know what it's going to look like in a couple months when AIPAC really plays harder in some of those districts.
Yeah, and those primaries are going to be hugely important and I think are going to get a lot of attention. So I would encourage people to keep an eye on those.
Yeah. Well, we'll put it on the agenda. Next, I did want to end on polls. I know it's early and a lot of people may have feel like they've been burned by polls predicting the outcome of the presidential races and, you know, how the House and Senate are going to go. But I do think it's worth checking at this stage on the polling around the presidential race, because it does determine and dictate questions around spending and where to campaign. So I did want to do a check-in. Erin, what are the big trends that you're seeing around polls that are sticking out to you or you think we should be paying attention to?
Yeah, and I think it's an important time to start looking at these, because we're starting to see the former president on trial, which is a potential X factor that we've been looking at for a while. Whether, you know, I don't think this is necessarily about that, but we have seen some tightening in the national polls recently. We've seen President Biden gaining a little bit. We're all within the margin of error on these things, and we're going to be throughout this campaign. So, you know, it's hard to say how significant that shift is. But what we're seeing more and more is that the race is something around tied nationally. A number of polls have shown movement in Biden's direction. But also keep in mind that a race being tied nationally probably isn't good enough for Democrats. President Biden won nationally by more than 4 percentage points in the popular vote in 2020, but only by around 1 point in the decisive states. Mm. So really, Democrats need to build a little bit of a lead in the popular vote, but things at least seem to be moving in the right direction. And one of the reasons for that appears to be a shifting third party dynamic. The votes for Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the independent candidate who's been pulling double digits in a lot of these polls, suddenly, at least in these national polls, three of them this week, suddenly appears to be coming more at Donald Trump's expense. So there was one poll that showed 16% of Trump voters were going for Kennedy when the race was expanded to include third-party candidates versus 10% for Biden. Similar in NBC News and Marist College polls. To the extent that that is a reflection of where things are headed, I think it's significant because it suggests that the third-party impact, at the very least, isn't necessarily the liability for President Biden that we might have thought it would be otherwise.
Yeah, it was just interesting because Kennedy was running as a Democrat and then decided to go independent. And there was a lot of thought of, oh, he's actually going to be more of a liability for Biden running as an independent than Trump. So what you're saying is it suggests that perhaps that's not the case. Obviously, it's very early. Colby, I'm wondering what you're thinking, where your head's at with these polls.
Yeah. You know, I tend to be a little bit of a poll skeptic after, you know, the last several election cycles. And I've been having a lot of conversations recently with a man named Simon Rosenberg, who is a national Democratic strategist, who, you know, in 2022, when everyone was yelling that there's going to be a red wave, was saying like, no, we have to look at other factors outside of polls. And he ended up being right. And he likes to, you know, he reminds us very often that he was right.
I would too. Yes, I would.
As he should, you know. Yeah. If I was right, I'd tell everybody all the time.
He tells everybody. But in conversations with him, it's just been fascinating. He's bullish on the fact that Biden wins in the fall. And he points to a few things. He points to, you know, he thinks that abortion is way more potent than maybe the polls are showing, that people maybe are unenthusiastic about Biden, but they're pretty motivated around the issue of abortion. Also, the idea that the more that Trump is kind of out there, the more that the trials are talked about in mm-hmm. the media, the more that we're kind of the nation is reminded of some of President Trump's shortcomings, the less likely it is that people that are kind of on the fence will choose Trump over Biden. I think one of Biden's greater concerns is the people that stay home. The belief is that if you have turnout that looks kind of similar to 2020, Biden's going to win. But are you going to have these young people, the young people that are disaffected about Gaza, people that are just feeling like government's broken, that are frustrated by the choices? They're not happy that they have this binary choice between Trump and Biden. Do they stay home? And if they stay home, that's a problem for Biden. But if people come out, if they decide it's important to come out and vote, there is this belief that Biden can prevail.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. This is coming from this Democratic strategist, and that's sort of the mindset or the playbook that, you know, maybe before them in the party, that they have to really focus on turnout And yeah, it's an open question as to whether people will want to do that, especially given all the things we've talked about today.
Yeah, I think it's a really important point to focus on turnout too, because if you look at surveys of the presidential race, what you see is that voters who are more reliable voters, voters who have voted, you know, not just in the last presidential election, but also in the 2022 midterms, the 2018 midterms, the more frequent voters, you know, the more frequent your voting is, the more likely you are to vote for Biden. It's a kind of a reversal from the way things used to be in our politics. It's now a good thing for them. You know, Trump has kind of created a coalition where voters aren't as interested in voting when he's not on the ballot. And so it creates a situation where it's uncertain whether the Republican base is going to be enthusiastic enough to turn out. Are they reliable enough voters to turn out? And so the percentage of Americans who come out and actually vote in the 2024 election is going to be hugely important.
Yeah. And obviously the trials could also, you know, motivate people to vote for him. So, yeah, there's that, too. Looking ahead to next week, I did want to ask both of you, what will be the big story that you'll be paying attention to?
Well, I think it's possible we're going to see testimony from Michael Cohen next week. The Cohen testimony is really the main event in this. So, you know, prosecutors questioning him, the cross-examination from Trump's lawyers. It's going to be very interesting, especially given that this is somebody whose credibility has very rightly been called into question. And so that's a big one for me. And then just kind of moving forward, not necessarily next week, but, you know, we're all awaiting a ruling from the Supreme Court on presidential immunity. It does not appear that they are going to give Trump his full immunity, that it's going to absolve him of any criminal liability in these criminal trials. But they could do some very significant things when it comes to potentially insulating the president more, on a more limited basis from criminal charges moving forward. So I think that's a very significant thing. We had the hearing on that on Thursday, and I think it's a very significant thing for for the presidency moving forward.
Right. Colby?
Yeah. And again, not necessarily next week, but I'm just going to continue to kind of be talking to voters and feeling out how these various issues are playing among real people. You know, it's not scientific, obviously. You're not capturing, you know, I can't talk to as many people as a poll can talk to, but you can kind of get a feeling when you're out there talking to people. You can sense the frustration. You can sense the angst over the price of things. You can sense the feeling that, oh, I wish there was someone else to vote for in this presidential election. And then you can also, you know, I hear a lot of, like, you know, from swing voters in these battleground areas, you know, like a kind of an eye roll about Biden, but a kind of more of a disgust about Trump. And so how does that play out in November? I'm going to keep kind of asking those questions and seeking out those conversations.
Well, the Post is lucky to have you out on the ground talking to voters, Colby. That's it for today's episode. Thank you, Colby, for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
And as always, thanks, Aaron, and I will see you next week.
Thank you. And don't forget to subscribe to the Campaign Moment newsletter. You can find a link to it in our show notes.
That's right. And Colby Ikowitz is a national politics reporter for The Post, and Aaron Blake is a senior political reporter. That's it for this week on the Campaign Moment. If you are tuning in via Post reports, we'll keep bringing you these conversations most Fridays. But also, you should go ahead and follow the Campaign Moment podcast feed as well. Earlier this week, as Aaron mentioned, he released a bonus episode with our colleague Roz Helderman about what the Manhattan Trump trial could mean for the campaign. And there will be many other additional conversations that you won't want to miss. So the best way to not miss it is to hit follow on the Campaign Moment right now. Today's episode was produced and mixed by Renny Svernovsky. It was edited by Renita Jablonski and Lucy Perkins. Our team also includes Ted Muldoon, Rena Flores, Monica Campbell, Alana Gordon, Ariel Plotnick, Bishop Sand, Sabi Robinson, Emma Talkoff, Sean Carter, Peter Bresnan, Allison Michaels, Martine Powers, and Maggie Penman, who just welcomed our newest and youngest audio team member, Frankie. Welcome, Frankie. I'm Elahe Izadi. Have a great weekend.
Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, the Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Class is in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.